students a blasphemous Charlie Hebdo cartoon of the Prophet Muhammad. Many, however, feel the latest attack came as a result of the political discourse in France, often described as racist and Islamophobic, targeting all Muslims and not just those with a violent Takfiri ideology. Anger has spread across the Islamic world with protests and boycotts of French goods, as Muslims condemn French President Emmanuel Macron for pouring fuel on the fire and not taking measures to dampen emotions. Muslims have gathered outside the French embassy here in London to join the global movement to condemn President Macron for supporting insults against Islam's holy prophet Muhammad. Our correspondent Robert Carter headed down to the embassy to see just how hurtful the French insults have been for British Muslims.
Outside the French embassy in London, angered British Muslims gathered to vent their frustrations. The protest comes amid rising violence in France over the ongoing debate of freedom of speech versus freedom to insult.
This is just one of the many protests taking place across the Muslim world. Muslims are indeed angry over what they say is deep insult by Western society led by France against Islam and its holiest figures. France claims that it's defending freedom of speech, but Muslims say that they feel indiscriminately persecuted in France and are targeted relentlessly by Western political leaders and by media sources too.
The focus of the anger was squarely pointed on the French president for his passionate defense of anti-Islam insults.
First and foremost, he needs to apologize and he needs to make a law that freedom of speech should have some limits. This is not freedom of speech. If I come and say to your father, if I start swearing at him, do you think that is freedom of speech? That's not. In the whole world, there are 1.7 billion Muslims. They will be ready to sacrifice their life in the name of Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. That the message should be very clear.
However, protesters also made clear why defending the Prophet is so important.
It insults us, it insults the entire Ummah, the entire 1.7, if not more, billion people around the globe, because our Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam is closer to our hearts. He is more dear to us than the entire world, our family, our parents, children, whoever it may be. Anyone in this world does not compare to our Prophet beloved Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam.
Not only is it just disrespectful, it's just the mere fact that I wouldn't do that to anyone else in religion, or mock it in any kind of form, or like, let alone do such an outrageous move, especially if you're in such a position of power. It's not only just disrespectful, it makes me feel quite hurt.
And the fact they disrespected us while doing nothing, this is really disrespectful. And that's why we're here. We're here to prove that we're here for our Prophet. Because without our Prophet, we're nothing. We wouldn't be Muslims. And I'm very proud to be Muslim. Alhamdulillah. The Prophet means everything. And the Prophet must mean everything. Because I adore him more than my mom, my dad, my siblings, everyone that I'd love. Because he is the reason that I'm Muslim. He is the reason that I'm going to go to Jannah, heaven. He is everything to me.
Muslim resentment against France is still growing. Will Macron finally back down or choose to stand by his anti-Islam policies? The answer for now still remains unclear. Robert Carter, London.
Former British opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn has vowed to fight his suspension from the Labour Party after he refused to retract his comments following a report into anti-Semitism in Labour, this by the UK's Equality and Human Rights Commission.
What I'll be doing is appealing to the party and those that have made this decision to kindly think again. All I've done is pointed out that this terrible issue of anti-Semitism does exist, and anyone that has anti-Semitic views has no place in the Labour movement or the Labour Party. And we have to deal with it. That is why I set up a process to deal with it.
The report made no recommendations and did not find institutional anti-Semitism in the party, but said that there were two cases that would constitute a failure of leadership. Corbyn acknowledged the report's findings, but concluded that claims of widespread anti-Semitism were overstated for media and political reasons. This angered party officials, including leader Sir Keir Starmer, who took the final decision to suspend Corbyn. Now, for more analysis, we have London's former mayor, Ken Livingstone, with us. Ken, good to see you here. Your reaction to Jeremy Corbyn's suspension, sir?
Well, what Jeremy Corbyn said is simply stating the truth. We had a small number of people with anti-Semitic views in the Labour Party under Jeremy's leadership, about 300 out of 500,000 members, and he had them investigated and expelled. He sorted the problem out. The idea that the Labour Party would be institutionally anti-Semitic is ridiculous. We were the main homeland for Jewish voters for over a century. We had more Jewish MPs than every other party put together. And, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn, I mean, we've been together, working together for 50 years, challenging every form of racism, anti-Semitism, homophobia. And this was all about, as Jeremy said, undermining him, getting rid of him, because the establishment fear a socialist being elected. Just look what was said about Bernie Sanders when he was running for the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party. He was depicted as a communist. Well, actually, he was no more than what we would call a liberal.
Now, Ken, you were name-checked in this report. First of all, do you know why and how that linked to Jeremy Corbyn?
Well, no, this is what's so outrageous. I mean, the report smears me, implies I'm anti-Semitic, but it doesn't give any detail. It doesn't just refer to a single thing I've ever said or done which is anti-Semitic. And also, even more outrageous, to produce a report like this without interviewing me and questioning me. But you see, all of this started, you know, 4.5 years ago when the then Labour MP, John Mann, had a television camera filming him shouting in my face I was a Nazi apologist, then launching this big lie that I'd said Hitler was a Zionist. And even yesterday, when I was being interviewed by a TV crew, they were saying, why did you say Hitler was a Zionist? I think, well, how long does this lie go on around the world?
Now, when it comes to these kinds of accusations, you were very clear there about your personal stance, but we want to know, why are we still defending the Labour Party here? Have they not shown that this perhaps is not the home for true leftists in this country?
Well, no, it is. I mean, and literally, although I disagree with Keir Starmer suspending Jeremy Corbyn, I think Keir Starmer can win the next general election, but also he is genuinely a socialist. I mean, if you look at his past, his manifesto when he was running for Labour leader, and I think he could be the most competent Labour Prime Minister since the Attlee government of 1945. And although I disagree with him about what he's done with Jeremy, I will work all I can to get him into Downing Street at the next election.
So there will be no Ken Livingstone Corbyn breakaway movement?
Of course not. Jeremy's made absolutely clear. Everyone stay in the party, work to get beyond this. Because basically, I think this issue, all these allegations about anti-Semitism are now likely to fade away. Keir Starmer's going to focus on the economy and the mess that Boris Johnson's government is making in Britain. And that's what we've got to focus on and do. I mean, at the time of the next general election, I'm going to be 80 years old. Jeremy will be about 77 or 78. We're just two old age pensioners. We'll do a bit of canvassing.
Now, of course, there's no getting away from the fact that this move has angered a lot of trade unionists. They've angered a lot of people on the left. Keir Starmer clearly needs to bring the party together, bring people back into the fold. How might he do this?
Well, I think what defines my perspective of Keir Starmer, when he first got the nomination to stand for Parliament, about the first thing he did, he asked to come and see me and get my advice about how to be an MP, what to do and all that. So I think this man is genuinely Labour. And this has been a huge... He's inherited this mess about anti-Semitism. I mean, Jeremy should have been much firmer in stamping down on all these lies and smears back when I was suspended 4.5 years ago. But I think we now put it behind us and focus on the serious issues about the economy, our welfare state, the neglect of our NHS, and get this ghastly government out.
There is, of course, the very delicate point here that still needs to be clarified. Where is the line between criticizing Israeli policies and anti-Semitism? Because we do know, unless this is made really clear, we're going to have a lot of other members falling foul of this grey area or this made-up situation.
Well, I mean, basically all my life, I mean, I've watched anyone who criticizes the policies of the Israeli government about their mistreatment of the Palestinians gets denounced as anti-Semitic. This is just an attempt by the Israeli government to shut down any criticism of their policy. And all I'd say to the Israeli government is this. We're now over 70 years since the State of Israel was created. The problem of the millions of Palestinian refugees still is there. And the Israeli government needs to reach out to the Palestinians and resolve it. And tragically, that almost happened 25 years ago when the then Israeli MP, at Prime Minister, did a deal with Yasser Arafat. And I remember thinking we're on the first step to resolving this problem. But then, of course, an extreme right-wing supporter of Benjamin Netanyahu party murdered him, assassinated him, and since then we haven't had that progress. So it's possible to reach out and do that deal, and I urge the Israeli government to do it.
Strong words there, Ken Livingston. Thank you, as always. And it's to Russia we go now, where the country's daily tally of coronavirus cases has surged to a record high of over 18,000, taking the national total close to 1.6 million cases since the start of the pandemic. Authorities have also reported 355 deaths in the past 24 hours, bringing the official death toll to over 27,500. However, residents in Moscow who want Russia's newly developed Sputnik V vaccine might be able to do so from as early as next month. So far, 2,500 people, primarily doctors and teachers, have already been vaccinated. Now, France has once again entered a national COVID lockdown. Non-essential shops have been shuttered and people have been told to work from home wherever possible. But restrictions are slightly less strict than during the country's two-month shutdown in the spring, with schools scheduled to reopen next week. The measures will last until at least December the 1st, with anyone leaving their homes required to carry a special document or otherwise face fines. To Spain now, where the country's parliament has voted in favour of extending a nationwide state of emergency by 6 months, thereby giving regional authorities extra powers to control a second wave of the coronavirus. Spain is one of Europe's worst COVID-19 hotspots, with over 3 million infections. Its response to the pandemic has often been hampered by political wranglings, but the government has managed to gather enough votes to extend the emergency powers. However, some local authorities have been heavily criticized for harsher restrictions and penalties on areas with migrants and low incomes. Robert Inlakesh, we cannot escape the two major stories of the day, especially if you are of faith or, in fact, none. Could you kick us off with your first choice, please?
The first one we're going to look at here is Sir Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party at this time, defending the suspension of Jeremy Corbyn over anti-Semitism and this new anti-Semitism report that has come out. And basically what we've seen from this is that the coup is complete of removing Jeremy Corbyn, also his allies from the Labour Party. And what we need to understand about this is that it is little to do with anti-Semitism, as it has been pointed out online, and more to do with basically people who are anti-war, who are pro-Palestinian, who are anti-corporations, who want socialist-leaning policies to go through. And so we see that the Blairite establishment inside of the Labour Party has conspired against Jeremy Corbyn and his allies. And of course, Zionist supporters of Israel inside of the United Kingdom, have conjured up these claims of anti-Semitism. They first did that, and then the entire establishment jumped on board to push this line because it was a stick to beat Jeremy Corbyn and his allies with. And he got too close, I believe that's what they viewed in their opinion. He got too close to a position of power, having someone who is going to implement socialist policy, someone who is going to be holding Israel accountable for its war crimes. And so, of course, they pull out the anti-Semitism stick to beat him with. Ultimately, what this is going to do is this is going to cause more anti-Semitism, because what they do is they conflate anti-Zionism and anti-Israel sentiment with anti-Semitism. And of course, when you do that, you sort of blur the lines, and so people see that it's all sort of free for all on Jewish people at this point, because they say, well, it doesn't really exist at this point. That's what it does. It brings forward anti-Semitism, and when you start claiming that Israel represents all Jewish people, then all the crimes of Israel are put onto Jewish people.
Let's be very clear about this. Jeremy Corbyn was not suspended from the Labour Party because of any of the actions highlighted in this report, but because he didn't walk back the comments he made in reference to this report and the original claims here, and he stood by that decision. What makes this so unique in your own mind, Robert Inlakesh, about the reason, the very scurrilous, tenuous reason that I believe he's been singled out for and suspended?
Well, what makes this so severe is the fact that anybody who is going to speak up on Palestinian rights now has to extra police their language when it comes to the issue. And we're talking about the most racist regime on earth when we're talking about Israel. We're talking about a regime which is ethnically cleansing people, which takes a racist, anti-Islam line on pretty much every single issue, and is murdering people and committing an ongoing incremental genocide in the case of the Gaza Strip. So when we talk about racism, there is no place which is worse when it comes to racism than Israel. But now we're having to police our language here in the United Kingdom for fear, especially in the Labour Party now, for fear of offending people who are racist. So that is one of the biggest takeaways from this, is that if you are going to stand up for Palestinian rights, you are going to have your political career taken away from you. If you're a journalist, you're going to be silenced. Your life is going to be destroyed. You're going to be smeared as a racist for being an anti-racist.
The irony has not escaped us. What's been the online reaction, Rob?
The first one we pulled up here is from Low Key Political Rapper. He says, "This is the coup. Where do you stand?" We've got another one commenting here as well from Hamed on Twitter. He says, "The fake world we live in. If you criticize the brutal Israeli government and support Palestinians and their freedom to fight anti-Semitism, and in France, the French president's remarks about Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and Islam is fine and allowed, is part of freedom of speech." We got another one here as well from Jim Bolton, who says, "I'm shocked by the actions of an unelected party official to suspend the former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn. It must be lifted immediately if elected to the NEC. I'll table a notion to overturn Jeremy's suspension at our first meeting."
Just a quick kind of devil's advocate position here. Do you sincerely believe that Sir Keir Starmer felt he had no option but to make a token gesture here? So he suspends Jeremy Corbyn, there is a hearing, Jeremy Corbyn is reinstated, we consider the matter closed and we move on.
Well, he's benefited directly from this coup of Jeremy Corbyn, and when it comes to it, I mean, he wouldn't want to feel a full victim to a coup himself if he was to take similar positions to that of Jeremy Corbyn. So being implicated in it, of course, he has a vested interest in pushing this. And on top of that, when it comes down to it, and looking like at the issues of anti-Semitism, why isn't he looking at the issues of Islamophobia or anti-black racism inside the Labour Party? Because all of these issues are going on. There are individuals, members of the Labour Party, who do say anti-Semitic, anti-black, anti-Muslim things all the time. We know this. This is just something which exists. And so why single out anti-Semitism and do all this gesturing, this over-the-top gesturing, by getting rid of Jeremy Corbyn?
All right. So we move from Islamophobia, anti-Palestine sentiments, claims of anti-Semitism, and we go over to France, where we talk about Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, and other issues. I mean, bring it up to speed for us, Rob.
Of course, everyone watching this is probably familiar with what is currently going down in France in terms of the crackdown on Muslims throughout the country. Of course, there was the terrorist attack yesterday as well. And this has only heightened the far-right extremism against Muslims inside of France. But the question that's being pulled up here is, why is it that anti-Semitism is completely unacceptable, as it should be, inside of France? For instance, you can't deny the Holocaust inside of France. And, you know, they say it's freedom of opinion and all things, but on this you cannot have freedom of opinion. So if you have one rule for one group of people, why is it that in the case of Muslims it seems to be a free-for-all? Even the Armenian genocide also is an offense to deny it. We know that France, they try and say that there's a separation of religion and state, but yet Emmanuel Macron has basically weaponized the hatred of Muslims in the country, so politicized religion inside of the country for a political aim. So he's actually using religion in the name of getting rid of religion out of politics and stopping extremism. He's causing more extremism on the right. He's isolating Muslims more. It's open season. On top of this, if we're talking about freedom of speech, why are they pushing anti-BDS legislation? Why are they stopping pro-Palestinian human rights rallies, for instance, like they've done in the past? And so there is a double standard which exists there, which many people are pointing out. If you have one rule for one group of people, why do you have another rule for another group of people? Do you have a fully secular state when you can go out and do these sort of things for one group of people but not the other? I mean, what are the principles that you are sticking by? You have to be consistent.
So you believe a lot of this inconsistency is about Macron recognizing that there are votes to be won here.
Absolutely. It seems that that is the case in the country, that he's playing to a base. And he's using Muslims at the moment, and he's cracking down on Muslims. And we see the reaction worldwide from this. If he wanted to stop violence, both against Muslims by far-right extremists and also from extremists who identify as Muslim, who are going to attack the French public, why do the things that he's been doing? You are putting the French people in a position where it's more likely that they're going to be attacked, whether they be Muslim or non-Muslim, from either side of this. You are exacerbating the issue when before it wasn't existing there. Where were these attacks months ago, before this whole thing happened, before he delivered his speech talking about Islam is in crisis and Islamist separatists, in his words, in the country, and talking about cracking down and then endorsing these insulting depictions of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. It didn't exist before this at such a large scale, but now he's exacerbating the issue, and he's putting his own population in harm's way, as well as his own Muslim population in harm's way, and targeting them.
Indeed. Quick social media reaction here, Robert.
First one we have here says, Islamophobic violence. Muslims in France right now are being beaten and stabbed because the president decided to blame all Muslims for someone's crimes. He even mocked our prophet. A lot of mosques are being taken down, etc. And there's no media coverage about this at all. We got another one here as well from Pam OB, a Twitter account. They say, I think it's very important for Muslims to denounce the Nice attacks. All Muslims need to apologize. And in reply to that, we have another one here from Yasser who says, using that logic, please condemn the Iraq war, slavery, the Vietnam war, European occupation of Africa, drone strikes, ethnic cleansing of Native Americans, etc.
Indeed. Strong words. Thank you very much, Robert. And that is where we leave the broadcast for tonight. Good night.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be looking at a question that often pops up in the minds of people, of theists who believe in God. Unfortunately, it's a problem which, if it's not properly addressed, can lead to disbelief and a denial and a rejection of the existence of God. So it's necessary for this to be addressed. This is the problem of the relationship between God's essence and his attributes. This is a tricky problem. It's a problem that has a long history in theological discussions. And many views have been expressed regarding this relationship. One of the views that has been expressed regarding it is a view of a theological sect within Islam called the Asha'ira. These people examine this problem in a very superficial manner. They say that the relationship between God's essence and his attributes is similar to the relation between our attributes and our essence, in the sense that just like our knowledge is extraneous to our essence but exists within it, or our power is within our essence but is extraneous to it, God's attributes are in a similar way extraneous to his essence but in him, just like a color exists in a body but is external to his essence, just like the weight of a body is external to his essence but exists within it, God's attributes are similar. Well, the answer to this theory is that if this were true, this would mean that God would need certain things other than his essence in order to possess these attributes. Obviously, if these attributes are different from him, external to his essence, they're different from him. At the same time, without these attributes, he wouldn't possess these properties, he wouldn't have knowledge, he wouldn't have power, he wouldn't have life, etc. So this means that, this implies that, God would need something other than himself in order to possess these perfections, in order to possess knowledge, in order to possess power, in order to possess life. Which is wrong. God is, one of the attributes of God is that he's ghani, he's self-sufficient, he doesn't need anything else other than himself. And this is absolute. He doesn't need anything else in order to exist, he doesn't need anything else in order to have knowledge, in order to know, in order to have power, in order to have life, in order to create. So it's necessary to reject this idea and to come to a more profound and precise explanation of the relationship between God's essence and his attributes. It's ironic that many years before this theory appeared, the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, in one of his sermons, which has been related in the book Nahjul Balagha, referred to this idea and rejected it. In the first sermon of the Nahjul Balagha, Imam Ali alayhi salam says the following: فَمَنْ وَصَفَهُ سُبْحَانَهُ فَقَدْ قَرَنَهُ وَمَنْ قَرَنَهُ فَقَدْ صَنَّاهُ وَمَنْ صَنَّاهُ فَقَدْ جَزَّاهُ وَمَنْ جَزَّاهُ فَقَدْ جَهِلَهُ. Imam Ali alayhi salam's sermon says that if somebody ascribes attributes to God which are additional to his essence, it means that in reality he has paired God with another being besides him. In other words, this attribute, like for example knowledge or power, if somebody does so, it implies that there's a multiplicity in him. It would mean that he's composed of parts, he's not simple in nature, and in essence this would mean that this person hasn't really understood what God is. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the problem of the relationship between God's essence and his attributes. Inshallah, in our forthcoming discussions, we will examine this more in detail. Until then, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Facing possible defeat in the U.S. presidential election, Donald Trump has again floated the idea of a rigged election, just days after his refusal to commit to a peaceful transfer of power, raising concerns that he might refuse to leave office, even if he loses the November vote. President Donald Trump has repeatedly cast doubt on mail voting, claiming that mail-in ballots lead to mass voter fraud. However, due to the coronavirus pandemic, millions of Americans prefer not to vote in person. At least in 9 states, every registered voter will automatically be mailed an application to request an absentee ballot. Experts believe that by escalating his ongoing attack on mail-in ballots, Donald Trump was ceding the ground to contest the election as rigged or fraudulent in the event of losing the election, and push the country into chaos. The president also sent shockwaves across the United States recently when he refused to commit to leave office peacefully if he loses this November's election. We're prepared for you an article written by Muhammad Mashhadi entitled "A Bizarre Election, American Democracy at Dead End." Please stay with us for more. U.S. presidential election will be on the line this November, but what about the American democracy? President Donald Trump's wrong policies and statements not only have dangerously made America's democratic health hang in the balance, but also the country's integrity as a whole. Many consider Donald Trump as a very example of a politician who values and respects no moral principles, and is so narcissistic and power-hungry that it is hard for him to imagine leaving the White House. From such a perspective, it seems that the upcoming election may prove more critical and controversial than previous ones. According to The Guardian, when asked during a press briefing at the White House on 23rd of September, Donald Trump replied, "We're going to have to see what happens, you know that. I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots, and the ballots are a disaster." Donald Trump refused to commit when asked again, "Get rid of the ballots and you'll have a very peaceful, there won't be a transfer, frankly, there will be a continuation. The ballots are out of control. You know it, and you know who knows it better than anybody else. The Democrats know it better than anyone else." Critics say Trump wants to maintain his power and will use every means to stay in the White House, even if it leads to a deep split in the country or even a civil war. U.S. President Donald Trump said at the Republican National Convention on 24th of August, "The only way they can take this election away from us is if it is a rigged election." Unless he wins a bona fide victory in the Electoral College, Donald Trump looks determined to refuse to concede defeat, and his mere denial of defeat may have cascading repercussions. Facing possible defeat in the U.S. presidential election, President Donald Trump has once again floated the idea of a rigged election, just days after his refusal to commit to a peaceful transfer of power, raising concerns that he might refuse to leave office even if he loses this November's vote. Donald Trump tweeted, "Rigged election," on Monday, 28th of September, along with a video purportedly showing a man caught on camera whilst paying cash for ballot exchange. The video shows a man buying a registration form for an absentee ballot for a voter, giving him pocket money of $200 and expecting to collect his ballot when the voter receives it. The man is heard saying, "Okay, when I fill it out, I'll bring it to you." Donald Trump has repeatedly cast doubt on mail-in voting, claiming that mail-in ballots lead to mass voter fraud. However, due to the coronavirus pandemic, millions of Americans prefer not to vote in person. At least in 9 states, every registered voter will automatically be mailed an application to request an absentee ballot. Experts believe that by escalating his ongoing attack on mail-in ballots, Donald Trump was ceding the ground to contest the election as rigged or fraudulent in the event of losing the election and push the country into chaos. His controversial remarks have drawn reactions from both Democrats and his own party members, with Republican Senator Mitt Romney saying in a tweet that a peaceful transition of power is fundamental to democracy. A Democratic lawmaker from California, Adam Schiff, described Trump's comments as an effort by the president to discredit the votes of millions of Americans, to stack the Supreme Court, to disenfranchise millions, and perpetuate himself in office by enlisting foreign assistance. Citing mail-in ballots, Donald Trump tweeted recently that this year's election may never be accurately determined. In another tweet, Donald Trump said, "Rigged election in waiting." In such a situation, it is natural for the American people to be in a panic about the future of their country because, in case of a civil war, all eyes will be on the U.S. Army. That is why top generals in the Pentagon have expressed their concerns about Trump's ordering active duty military into the streets of American cities to quell protests after the presidential election. Pentagon General Mark Milley of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in remarks released last month, made clear that the U.S. military is determined not to play a role in resolving the dispute over election results. General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said in written answers to questions from House lawmakers released last month, General Milley said, "I believe deeply in the principle of an apolitical U.S. military," adding, "In the event of a dispute over some aspect of the election, by law, U.S. courts and the U.S. Congress are required to resolve any disputes, not the U.S. military. I foresee no role for the U.S. armed forces in this process." On 11th of August, John Nagle and Paul Yingling, both retired U.S. Army officers and Iraq War veterans, published an open letter to General Milley on the website Defense One. They wrote, "In a few months' time, you may have to choose between defying a lawless president or betraying your constitutional oath," adding, "If Donald Trump refuses to leave office at the expiration of his constitutional term, the United States military must remove him by force, and you must give that order." Meanwhile, Donald Trump gave officials no solace when he refused to commit to a peaceful transfer of power, no matter who wins the election. On Thursday, 24th of September, he doubled down by saying he was not sure the election could be honest. His hedging, along with his expressed desire in June to invoke the 1807 Insurrection Act, to send active duty troops onto American streets to quell protests over the killing of George Floyd, has caused deep anxiety among senior military and Defense Department officials, who insist they will do all they can to keep the armed forces out of the presidential election this November. Despite statements by Pentagon spokesman Brooke DeWalt, who said recently that the Department of Defense has no role to play in the post-election transfer of power, experts predict that Donald Trump may use the insurgency law to deploy military officers on the streets to suppress the protesters amid controversial election results. The Insurrection Act is a federal law that enables the president to deploy U.S. Federal Army personnel in special circumstances, such as the suppression of disorder and insurgency within American cities. Given that Trump and the Republican Party will not accept the result of this November's elections, there are reports that Democrats may refuse to accept the election results if Donald Trump wins. At the same time, there have been reports of renewed anti-racist protests in U.S. cities after a grand jury's decision on Wednesday, 23rd of September, not to bring charges relating to Breonna Taylor's death. The grand jury decided not to bring direct charges against three police officers: Breonna Taylor, a black female who was killed in the city of Louisville, Kentucky. In New York, anti-racism protesters blocked Brooklyn Bridge during the Breonna Taylor demonstration and demanded justice for the black woman killed by police officers. The recent events reveal America's true face, which was once a dreamland for those who look for democracy. It seems that November's presidential election will turn into a nightmare if both nominees, or even one of them, reject the results of the election. In that case, it will undermine conceptions like American Dream and Great America. The upcoming danger is not merely that the 2020 presidential election will bring political and social split. Americans fear something much worse may happen. The country is facing highly serious challenges, such as the coronavirus pandemic, a reckless leader, deep-rooted racial discrimination, and failed political system that is apt to resort to violent acts against protesters. There are enough to overthrow empires or superpowers. According to the New York Times, from Myanmar to Canada, people are asking, how did a superpower allow itself to be felled by a virus? And why won't the president commit to a peaceful transition of power? We should take warning by New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman seriously when Friedman declared recently that the United States could be headed towards a second civil war following Donald Trump's comments around not carrying out a peaceful transition of power should he lose this November's election. New York Times' Thomas Friedman said, "You know, I began my career as a journalist covering Lebanon's civil war and in its history. I'm terrified to find myself ending my journalistic career covering America's potential second civil war in its history."
Imagine you're living in the sun belt of the world, where the heat of the sun is fierce even the depths of winter. Imagine you're living in one of the most impoverished countries in the world. You have no job, money, insurance, health system, clean water, nothing, and you don't know from where or when your next meal will come. Imagine your country is torn apart as a result of a bloody war, and the enemy is viciously targeting all civilian infrastructure, including the national grid. Without electricity, your country will regress to an age of darkness. The wheels of industry will come to a halt. Hospitals won't function properly, and everyday life will become a living hell. If you're in Yemen, you don't need to imagine yourself in all these horrible situations. You're already part of this human tragedy. Among endless problems induced by the war, long hours of power outages have created an invisible pain that runs through the whole country. The power cuts reach 8 hours a day, sometimes reaching 24 hours. It's like hell. We cannot sleep because of the high heat. We are living and dying in the dark. These are common sentences that can be heard in Yemenis' everyday conversation.
When you see that they attack electricity stations, power lines, power stations as well, and also blockade the oil industry and the oil import that is so necessary for the fuel, for the electricity production in Yemen. One of the major reasons behind this is that they want to break Yemen's spirit. These are attacks that no longer target military goods, military or equipment or soldiers of the Yemeni Republic.
Power outages have left almost all major cities in the dark since the onset of the war in 2015. The Saudi-led coalition has destroyed many transmission lines, power stations, and other electricity facilities, crippling the country's critical center. Yemen's Ministry of Electricity says the coalition has targeted more than 5,000 power stations and other pieces of critical energy infrastructure, most of them away from any fighting for military site. According to the ministry, 90% of the total Yemeni population are living without electricity.
There have been several reports already that there are a lot of health centers. Reports speak about the majority of health centers and hospitals in Yemen having shut down due to a lack of power and due to a lack of fuel necessary to fuel their generators. And the same goes for institutions such as oxygen factories that produce necessary oxygen tanks and oxygen machinery and equipment in order to keep people alive during life-saving surgery.
In April 2016, Saudi warplanes destroyed the main power station in Taiz province. 4 months later, in August, they dropped bombs on two generating stations at Harav and Midi in Hajah province. 8 bombs also targeted the main power station in Amran, destroying 2 transformers. The coalition had already bombed in July 2015 a compound housing employees of a power plant and their families, killing and injuring more than 300. Some families have reportedly pulled their children out of school to fetch water as electric pumps have become useless. And those students who still go to school cannot study without electricity when night comes. Needless to say, the surface water children and women fetch is often contaminated with cholera and other bacteria.
You have to bear in mind that take away a nation's electricity and you make them drop back decades, if not centuries, into the past. And whereas, of course, you can say, in the past people survived as well, the sudden drawback, the sudden collapse that the sudden cutting of all power causes will immediately, and in the course of weeks and months even more, cause a mass amount of civilian deaths. This is basically unavoidable if you take such a drastic step as to cut off an entire nation's power for an extended period of time.
Meanwhile, a handful of factories that have survived the war are now closed down in the absence of electricity. Long-lasting power outages have been taking their toll on Yemeni patients whose lives are dependent on life-saving facilities.
When lengthy power outages occur, the emergency backup generators may not always cut the hit and may not always be enough to keep the power running for a long time in places such as hospitals, emergency centers, childcare services, factories that produce necessary medical and other equipment. So this has had a very intense direct result for thousands of people in Yemen who are suffering from medical conditions, people who have been wounded due to the bombings, for example, that Saudi Arabia has been carrying out in Yemen for years now.
Yemen's Public Electricity Corporation has estimated that the financial damage from these measured attacks on power infrastructure adds up to over $4 billion.
When they seek to destroy Yemen completely, this is their way of indeed reducing the country back to ashes, and then later on come back with some a few billions of petrodollars to build up the country back as a Saudi puppet state, and then portray the money that they gave as an act of charity. This is a very typical Saudi strategy that we have seen in this region in particular.
Yemeni citizens now have to pay a monthly subscription fee of up to 350 to 400 Yemeni riyals to private sector producers. Many Yemeni families cannot afford it. Before the war, it was just 7 Yemeni riyals per kilowatt. Years of indiscriminate airstrikes and bombardments have destroyed the national grid and contaminated large areas across Yemen, including areas through which power lines pass, turning them into fields full of mines and unexploded bombs. In the words of Abdul Qadir Motahar, Director General of Transportation at the Electricity Corporation, "We have 490 electric towers in the Sana'a Marib line that passes through now, most of which are now destroyed or affected by the raids, shelling, and unexploded ordnance."
The blame for Western countries goes much further than merely selling weapons. Of course, when you sell weapons, I mean, my native country of Belgium has recently ceased selling weapons directly to much of the Saudi military, but not all, I believe. But before that, the Belgian government always said, like, we sell these weapons to the Saudis. What they do with it afterwards is not exactly our fault. You know, that is, they try to kind of turn around a little bit and shift the blame away that way. But the blame goes much further than that, especially in countries like the United Kingdom and the United States. They don't just sell weapons to Saudi Arabia, but they are directly involved in intelligence services. There are American and British forces and Israeli forces and experts directly present in the war rooms of the Saudi-led coalition.
The Yemeni Executive Mine Action Center says the dense amount of mines and unexploded ordnance that are now spread near electric transmission lines is huge. It'll take a long time before teams are able to reach them to start the rebuilding process. It is clear that a poor country like Yemen, which cannot secure even the basic staples of life, cannot get rid of these huge amounts of unexploded remnants and landmines in the near future. With the help of Ansarullah, Yemeni citizens have just started using solar energy. But the question is, will the Saudi-led coalition allow them to use it for a long time? And will light overcome darkness in the end?
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.